Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Morning. There's Beth.
Here I am.
We can start the party now.
Oh boy.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I should probably start with some appropriate medical facts.
I'm worried, but I guess
so,
I'll grant you that.
You know, there's been research on the COVID virus with animals, and you've seen a couple of case reports of dogs being, I think, infected or whatever. Well, there's just some new reports out on insects, and it turns out that insects may have some immunity to the COVID virus, in particular ants, because, well, it's been documented they have little ant bodies.
Okay. Once again, Dr. Harrington, I would recommend that you not give up your day job.
Yeah, that comes from my brother, a fellow dad. So,
all right. Well, that's a great way to start off our public health meeting on a light note. So now maybe we can move on to what's actually going on out there. So I would invite our public health department to provide us an update.
Absolutely. Well, I think my hair has gotten a little curlier the past week, but we are moving forward, and Dr. Harrington and I have spent a considerable amount of time looking at our data. I think that is one of the things that we are looking at right now in terms of reconciling some of our cases that we've had and, you know, just making sure what numbers we have are matching CDPHE. So we'll get into a little bit about that here. I wanted to update on our Haven situation. So when we did testing on the 26th, we had two additional positives from that testing session last week, but we have not heard anything since then, so that's good news. And we were in contact with them and working with their staff and making sure, you know, they had the appropriate and adequate PPE to address that situation. So we have that. And I know Dr. Harrington will go over some of the numbers, but, you know, we've had a couple cases, you know, in the community as well, and we are looking at those. And I just really, you know, this past week, I really gained such an appreciation for the work that our contact tracers are doing. I mean, they have done a superb job with me being able to send them positive case results, and they are on it, and they are making phone calls. We tallied up some of the phone calls they made just last week, and it was 71 phone calls. And so this is not, you know, a small task by any means. And I just wanted to send that message out that we've got just stellar people working for us. And whenever we go through the cases, for every positive case, there's all this activity that happens behind the scenes. And I think those phone calls do represent, you know, what we're doing to follow up on those positive cases. So I wanted to start out with the kudos to that team and for their support. So that has been truly, truly amazing. I don't know, Dr. Harrington, if we want to talk about the numbers now and discuss that. What I have found in just the past week in this role is a lot of our hand counting is really cumbersome. We are taking data from multiple data sources. We've got positive cases that are coming in. We are still working, Commissioner Melton and I are still working on getting access to CDRS. This seems to be a little technical issue, I think, at the state level. I guess I've had too many CEDARS accounts in my past life that maybe is proving to be a little challenging. But we have been getting updated spreadsheets from Tom Orr, who is our representative in Mesa County for the region. So he has been sending me updated data in the mornings so that I can see what is being reported on the CEDARS list. This is the data from CDPHE that they are using for their website. So we've had some discussions around that data this week, and even until just a couple minutes ago with Dr. Harrington. So the hand counting, a little bit cumbersome, but we are pulling it together, and I think we're solidifying how we want to truly understand our data better, and by using the date that the sample was collected rather than reported, because the collection date is that snapshot in time. It's that moment in time when the person got their testing, and that result ties back to that moment in time, which would show us our prevalence more accurately than the date that the result was reported because of some of our testing issues. We are seeing a somewhat quicker turnaround in some of our testing. It's a little bit variable. We had one testing site that we did on the 30th, and we received the results the next day. So it was within 24 hours. So it was, that was a little bit like of a shocker. We're like, oh, that's great. And CDPHE is working on some of those priority levels on how those labs are going to be run. And they had a meeting yesterday that really outlined the different tiers. So that's a little bit of background to our data, our numbers. And Dr. Harrington, if you want to share our latest numbers, and then I was going to also pull an Emmy for kind of a discussion moving forward.
Okay. Yeah, as Roberta says, and Roberta has done even way more work on this than I have. I give credit to Michelle Lewis, who was doing all this stuff by hand before. It's hard, and we're working to make this a better process, and we'll come back to that. So I'll talk about three things. I'll talk about our case count. I'll talk about some breakdown of cases I looked at, and then I'll talk about the new antigen test that's coming out. So here's our case count over the past 2 weeks. I'll remind us that we are using a Monday through Sunday definition for a week. So that way, as we get into like this week, you know, we started trying to tabulate data on Monday and Tuesdays. There's always a lag of at least 48 hours, if not longer, in test results. So it's possible we'll still have a couple cases come back in the days ahead. But here's what we know. We've had 15 cases over the past 2 weeks. And I would suggest that this is very consistent with what we've seen throughout July, frankly. We've been averaging about 7-8 cases a week. We seem to be pretty stable with that. This case count does include our Haven outbreak. Mm-hmm. Currently at the Haven, we have 10 residents and staff who have tested positive. That also includes one death, which I can confirm. Both the tests came back positive finally yesterday, but clinically it also fit. We have the 7 folks that are Rauch County residents. So you could consider that when you look at the total of 15. And of course, for example, on July 22nd, that was a round of testing that we did at the Haven, and we had several positives from that. So again, I look at this data, I see us being stable in our disease prevalence as indicated by positive cases in our community. We do not have our local case positive rate for this week, although I would guesstimate that it is relatively unchanged. By that I mean our positive cases have continued at about the same clip, and our testing, I would assume, is about the same clip. We've got various clinics doing testing, UC Health Test Center site, we did our day, So I think our case positivity rate is staying roughly the same. Before I move on to a couple other points, any questions about this particular data set and the histogram in front of you?
Go ahead, Beth.
I'm just looking at the press release that we put out yesterday, which lists 20 cases over the last 2 weeks. So can you just clarify that discrepancy?
Absolutely. We report cases as we get the results reported in. The reporting date does not equal the test collection date. And the test collection date, Roberta referred to this, you know, is much more important for us making our public health decisions than the reporting date, because reporting date can be 2 days, can be 8 days, we've even seen later. So we try to meet the desire of others to get the information as soon as we get it. So we put those out, and we will be, I think, doing a little more data inclusion going forward in terms of trying to list when the date was collected so that people can have that clarity of knowing, okay, it's we've got 20 cases reported, but you can look and see when the dates collected were, and you'll see that some of them were collected actually before our 2 week accounting period.
So the 20 cases are the 20 positives that we've gotten back in the last 2 weeks, but in
Correct.
Terms of when they were collected, we've had 15. Okay.
Correct.
Thank you.
Correct.
Yeah. And some of those test dates, you know, go back to the 15th, you know, or earlier. So, and that's representative of this lag time in the lab situation for, you know, not only samples being sent to the state, but other commercial labs as well.
So to be clear, this graph that we're looking at right now is date of test results.
That is correct. And how we've always presented our information is on the date collected. But of course, that, as we just talked, can vary from the report date.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's, I mean, I think that highlights some of the confusion mm-hmm. that's out there in the public. And I mean, it's almost a case to really only present the information as it appears in this graph rather than that big number of positive cases that really doesn't help us understand what's going on. Although on the other hand, I imagine there'll be people in the public that would disagree with that and really want to hear about the positive cases as soon as they happen. But it does come with a lack of context.
And that's been our standard. I mean, we'll hear of a case report, I don't know, at noon, and we're getting a press release out by supper time that, okay, we've had two more cases reported today. Mm-hmm. That's been our standard throughout this to give the information as soon as we have it in hand.
Right.
I would just, I'm sure you guys know this, but I would just put forth that looking at that press release from yesterday and then talking about it in this way today, it's a little confusing. And so I would just maybe suggest that we work toward being a little more consistent, because I think looking at that press release and it lists every case and it's they're numbered 1 through 20. And then that's in conflict with what you're reporting today. So I don't think it's a matter of what we do and don't report. I think it's being more consistent in the way we report it. Obviously, we want to be transparent with all this information.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Commissioner Melton, I believe that's, you know, moving forward, you know, we're going to have to do this little bit of a reset with the data and moving forward. And Dr. Harrington, I don't know if we want to talk about some solutions that we've discussed with Emmy and some of her contacts.
Sure, and I'll come back later with a couple other issues.
Yeah, so we, Emmy, who is working with our graphs and is just fantastic in our GIS program here, she reached out and mentioned that she has connections with the epidemiologist that's working at Summit County. And, you know, Summit County and other counties have the same challenges that we have, you know, where you're doing the hand collection that's pretty cumbersome. And, you know, what, as we are, this is progressing forward, how do we move to a smoother solution? So I asked Emmy if she could maybe share some of the information she was able to get through Summit County, and maybe we can propose some solutions.
Yes. So thank you, Roberta. Kind of along those lines, it was kind of eerie hearing his story. It's nearly exactly what Rout is struggling with right now. So we're not alone in this. But they were struggling with making their numbers match with the state just managing the data in Excel spreadsheets. And it was just getting very cumbersome and quite frankly, overwhelming. And that's what he found when he came on board about a month ago. And after talking with other colleagues in his area and with the state, he learned that the state is providing data updates via a database or a table every single day towards the end of the day. And just for consistency's sake and efficiency, he convinced Summit that they should just be using that database exclusively and just match the state from there. So he set up a system where they can grab that data daily and run it through their systems and spit it out into their graphs and then provide more reliable data on a daily basis. Some of the things that we know with the state data is that it does lag. We don't get instantaneous data. If there's a new case today, it's not going to show up for maybe 3 to 4 days in the state data. So that's one issue to just keep in mind. I'm just reading my notes from our meeting here. Another thing that you just need to educate the public and ourselves on is that this table, the state data doesn't include out of county cases. So if we have somebody here semi-permanently or, you know, whatever, if their address is not here, they're not being assigned to Rout County. For Summit, that became way too overwhelming to try and track some of those. So they just, they're just using the state data and they know that there's a number of cases floating through Summit, if you will, as well. And then once they were ready to switch over to exclusively the state data, they just worked really hard on the messaging and education of both public health employees and the public on how they were gonna move forward. So they went from a system that was taking them more than 6 hours a day to update the data to now less than 45 minutes a day there. And he's got a pretty solid process down and he's gonna start working on sharing documents to the process that he's created there.
Great, thank you, Emmy. And so, you know, that would be kind of a gold standard, I think, for us to, at least if someone's already done the programming, what we're finding, you know, when we get these data sheets from CDRS is a lot of cleaning needs to happen with that data. I mean, we've got, you know, over 6,000 entries. So that's, you know, positive cases, negatives, people that have gotten repeat testing that might show multiple times. So, you know, the data needs to be cleaned appropriately. For, you know, removing duplicates and then, you know, going into these tables. So one of my thoughts was perhaps we could, in the interim, I'm interviewing our epidemiologist now as we speak. I've got one more interview today, but if we were able to potentially contract with this gentleman to help us kind of build a system that then we could transition to the epidemiologist that's coming on board, that might help with some consistency. So that was a thought.
I have a question, Emmy, about, like, I've looked at Summit County's data page, and then I also saw in the paper, I think in the Summit Daily, there was a story about how they were doing something new. They were rolling out something new. So is what you're talking about the new thing, not yes. What's currently on their website?
No, what the current dashboard is the new dashboard.
Oh, okay.
And yes, there's been some press about it in the last week here on their transition.
So I guess one question I have, I mean, just looking at some of their stuff, you know, they're putting out some charts that break down the cases by age, and they have a whole dashboard that shows where they are in comparison to the Protect Our Neighbors metric. So all that stuff is stuff that you would be looking at, maybe just kind of copying over and using our local data to fill those in.
Yeah. Instead of us trying to hand code age and gender and et cetera, the state data table that they're providing daily already has that broken out. And so that's one less thing for us to have to figure out.
That sounds like great news to me. You know, there's so much going on. It's great to be able to borrow from other resources from other places, I think.
So just to clarify, it sounds like we're headed towards using state data and reporting that data when it becomes available. So this does follow the direction that we gave, which was we're more interested in accurate information than quick information. And so our citizens, we just need to help them understand that they're just going to need to wait 3-4 days for the to get the latest numbers.
Yes.
I assume we would continue to report new positive cases as they come in. It's just the numerical data would not be updated for a couple days. Is that what you guys are thinking? Like via press releases and?
Well, so one idea is that we have Wednesday as our update day, right? Mm-hmm. So Wednesday mornings. Have the data, that's what we're working with for our Board of Health meeting, and that's our weekly update. And I think, Roberta, and Amy, correct me if I'm wrong, but we had that idea, because that's based a little bit on what Summit's doing, I believe. Mm-hmm. One day a week kind of main update, if I'm correct.
Mm-hmm. Summit is updating the data that feeds the dashboards every weekday by 10 a.m.
And then they were doing something on a weekly basis too, I think, but.
I'm not sure about that, yeah.
Anyway, yeah.
Yeah, the only caution, Commissioner Melton, is that, you know, some of these reports that come out, again, might be attributed to the person that came and visited, you know, a positive came through. And so then if you're keeping track of those reported positive cases that come out, they might not necessarily make the cut in the CDERS database, because if they were visiting from Denver, that would be attributed to Denver Public Health, so, and Denver County.
And so let me comment on that non-route thing, because our standard has, and I think will continue to be, that we report all the positive cases that are collected in Steamboat Springs, but some of those cases are visitors, so we don't, you know, we have somebody who might be here for several days, and while they're sick, they get tested. The other situation we have, though, which I think poses a little more of a quandary in how we discuss it, is that we have out-of-state residents who live here for extended periods of time. So second homeowners, and we've had many of these cases. They've been here for a month or two, and they come down with COVID. Clearly, they contracted the COVID here, and it's relevant to our discussions about the prevalence in the community. Because they're tax ID, zip code, and residence is in Texas, we don't get to count them on our route county list. So the convention that we've had, and Robin has done, is we do report those cases, and then we usually comment that they're an out-of-state resident, so they'll not count on our route county tally, but sometimes those cases, I think, are relevant to our discussion on how many cases we've had in the past couple weeks. Mm-hmm. But that's the kind of thing where nobody else is going to sort that out for us. We literally have to do that. Mm-hmm. So, along with trying to figure out this process, we still have facets of this that require us locally to put the pieces together and to put them in context.
So that's going to make it interesting for the people at home that are doing their self-stats and statisticians. And when we send out press releases and saying that, well, we had X number of whatever today and whatever, and making sure, I'm just, it's going to be an issue, because somebody's going to say, well, I didn't have exactly that number. So I figure out how to get and that.
Those press releases just need some kind of a disclaimer on them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess I was bringing it up for Robbins, you know, so that we still want to probably at that point in time want to refer to our official database, and you know, and that what we have, and you know, and the, and but I, you know, the positive communication is always good. I want to think, like Dr. Harrington said, I think we want to get make sure everybody's understanding of the numbers that are happening and the rest, but they're not all, maybe 2 + 2 does not equal 4 every time. So
I think it's you know, there's kind of two pieces of this. There's the information that the public wants, understandably. And then there's also just a matter of the information that we need for decision making. And I think that trend data is really important, but I'm so curious how other counties might be, that have a lot of tourism, might be thinking about those out of county cases, because it seems to me that while they may not be part of our official count, we do care, because they are part of understanding the disease prevalence in Route County. So I don't know if it's more of a, you know, a qualitative way of understanding those cases rather than trying, but I think they do matter for our decision making and for understanding disease prevalence in our community. Mm-hmm. And so maybe we can take the reporting, you know, how we report on that information, maybe a little bit separately from just how we consider that information as we're trying to make decisions about what needs to happen. And I don't know the exact right answer to that. But maybe we don't try to fit a square peg in a round hole. You know, we go with the official counts for our county, but we do have to consider that we have these other cases that are impacting disease prevalence in our community.
Yeah, I can kind of see where we might have the graph that Emmy was displaying as being the official one that reflects state data, and then creating a secondary graph that is basically the same graph that we somehow determine how many of those non-resident cases really should be included to guide our thinking in terms of public health. So, yeah, you know, I think the bottom line is that like Doug was talking about, all those at-home statisticians will probably never be satisfied with how we present the information. And what's important is that public health, and we as the Board of Public Health, really understand the important information. And we probably don't, I actually really appreciate Dr. Harrington's suggestion that we just do this once a week, because really, who cares what's happening day to day to day to day? You're going to have all these ups and downs and ups and downs. They don't really inform our thinking as much as the longer term trends.
Mm-hmm. Well, and a lot of places are really looking at that rolling 7-day or 14-day average as the most important number, which makes sense, at least in concept to me, that it's that rolling average.
Mm-hmm. And the trend line.
Mm-hmm. And the trend line of that rolling average, you know, not just the trend line on a day-to-day basis, right?
Mm-hmm. Commissioner?
Yeah, I've been doing at-home statistical work, so this is very interesting to me.
Commissioners, could I just add, Dr. Harrington or Roberta, could you just add what we talked about? I think another way to analyze that 7-day rolling average or 14-day average goes back to what Roberta was saying, is how we find the cases. You know, was it through contact tracing, testing? I think that we had a discussion about that. So if I just may be so bold, Dr. Harrington or Roberta, maybe you want to just explain why, you know, how we find the cases is so important as well about disease prevalence.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, some of those more recent positives that we have had were because they came to our community testing because they were a contact. So yes, that is important. And that is really essentially what surveillance is. And that is, you know, the nature of doing any kind of disease surveillance in a population is casting your net and seeing, you know, what you can get out of that. And if we have people that we know that might be at higher risk and we recommend for them to get tested, you know, we can understand a little bit maybe more about close contact and spread and understand, you know, some of the risk factors as well in our spread in the community. Dr. Harrington, I don't know if you want to add anything else to that.
Yeah, Roberta's inbox on her email and phone are getting filled up quickly. Rob and I have had stuff for some time, and I want to let the community know that we respond to their requests. I mean, you know, I had a handful of people saying, hey, how come you don't give us information on why the test was obtained? I said, well, you know, I mean, to myself, I said, I hadn't thought you'd be interested, but happy to do that. And so, and similarly, Robin's had some emails about, you know, wanting extra data stuff. And I mean, we're happy. Some of it's just the work involved to put this together. I mean, you know, for example, Robin's doing 50 things a day. I know that just getting out the case report press releases is not the only thing on her plate. And so everybody is doing their best, and we are trying to respond to people's wishes. The three of us, we've had many conversations about expanding information release all along the lines of these things that we've discussed.
Also, I want to add to that as well. If we start transitioning to using the CDERS data as our source, mother source of data, they have on their probable cases. And when you look at the CSTE, so that's the Council for State and Territorial Epidemiologists, they're the ones that set all the case definitions for all of our communicable disease outbreaks. They have a definition for probable cases, and all of those probable cases are not cases that necessarily had a positive COVID test necessarily, but they were linked epidemiologically to a positive case. So those are also reported in that CDERS database. And when you go to the state, you'll see, you know, the confirmed and then probables. And a lot of those probables, I think, do, again, give more information on how many do we have that, you know, meet kind of that CSTE case definition, and expands exactly that picture of what's happening in the community.
I have, I guess this is a question / comment. I think I remember that maybe it was the Harvard metrics that had a goal for the percentage of cases that were identified through contact tracing, mm-hmm. which also seems like there's some value in just understanding, you know, we're catching a lot of these through contact tracing versus we're not, right? Mm-hmm. Was it in the Harvard metrics? Do you remember?
They've got commentary, and I'm trying to remember. I mean, we've had those kind of discourses, I think, through several mediums. I've argued here locally that it's a good story when we have a case contact test as positive, because that tells us that we're tracking down the spread and hopefully stopping it at that point, rather than these people being out there unknown and potentially exposing other people. We will go back, I think, and try to at some point get our list up to date on as best as we can retrospectively. I mean, you know, in April, how did we find some of these cases? We may not be able to retrospectively put that up, but I know going forward, and we were doing this recently, we were trying to make note of how these patients were identified or why they got their test.
And then I would just make a general statement. I don't know, Tim and Doug, what your thoughts would be. I think in terms of resources, obviously we want to err on the side of transparency with the public, but in terms of the time and effort spent in data analysis, I think the priority needs to be the data that's important for policy decisions, mm-hmm. And for public health decisions. And the requests of members of the public for us to do certain types of analysis or whatever else has to be secondary to that, because we have to commit our resources to being able to make good decisions. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for stating the obvious. Yes.
Right. Well, and I believe that's going to be the role of our epidemiologist as well that we hire, because we need to gather all the information we can to do gap analysis, on, you know, what are our public health needs in the county beyond COVID and moving forward, and using that data, again, to drive those policy decisions. That's what's also going to help get us funding for some of these programs as well. So I do think that that is going to be the priority of the epidemiologists kind of moving forward as well.
So I can move on to just a couple other areas if that is a discussion.
Actually, I wanted to put Roberta on the spot in my never-ending quest to understand acronyms. Perhaps for the benefit of the public, you could let us know what the acronym CDERS stands for.
Oh, gosh. So I think it's the Colorado Epidemiologic CED reporting.
Well, that's your homework assignment, Roberta, for next week. Thank you.
My peripheral brain, it's the Colorado Electronic Disease Reporting System.
Oh.
I knew that. I just
I was
confirm with my peripheral brain. All right. I did with the database copies we were given, I was trying to find out some other helpful information from it. So one thing I did this week was, because this came up previously, was where are our cases in the county? And so based on one of the spreadsheets we're given yesterday, and again, I'm going to qualify, knowing that we're shy of a handful of cases on there, but that spreadsheet listed 108 cases. And in that spreadsheet, identified 9 cases in Hayden with a Hayden address, 6 cases with an Oak Creek address, 2 cases with a Yampa address, and therefore 91 cases in Steamboat with a Steamboat address, and no cases with a Clark or that area address. If I do that as percentage wise, I get 8.3% cases, or about 1 out of 12 occurred with a Hayden resident. And some of those, not all, it does include all of the recent Haven outbreaks, but it does include some of those cases. I had 5.6% for Oak Creek, 1.9% for Yampa, 84% for Steamboat Springs. Then if you put that relative to the populations, you know, this kind of how many cases per 100,000 count, by my calculation, based on 2018 census data that I Googled, I got that Hayden's case rate has been around 457 per 100,000. Oak Creek, 621 per 100,000. Yampa, 431 per 100,000. And Steamboat Springs, 689 per 100,000. And I'm sure with new cases coming in, all that, those numbers might change a bit, but that gives you a relative idea of how the cases have been spread around our county. Any questions about that?
Oh. Yeah, I mean, we've talked about this before, Dr. Harrington, which is, again, we're kind of the victim of small numbers, and it's awfully difficult to draw statistical conclusions from 2 cases here and 7 there. It's just, you know, if Yampa had 2 more cases reported, does that mean it's, you know, in a crisis, or that just happens to be 2 people?
Yeah, 100% changed from the week before. It went from 1 to 2.
And that could very well be purely a function of them working in Steamboat. It has nothing to do with.
Well, and here's one other little interesting thing to ponder. So if I take the 17 cases I tabulated, Oak Creek, Yampa, and Hayden, of those, only 4 cases were in people aged 40 and under. So that's a 1 in 4 rate, whereas previously I told you that when I looked at our data, I was finding that in general, we were about 2/3 were aged 40 and under. Just kind of an interesting observation there that the age distribution seems to vary between Steamboat and the other communities in the county. And I could come up with some explanations for that. I mean, the Steamboat workforce has a lot of people who've come here to ski and to do things in Steamboat, and those tend to be a younger population. Anyway, there's ways you can rationalize that. I just thought that was kind of interesting. If any of those kind of numbers held out, you could even fashion different approaches to disease mitigation in different communities based on kind of how those numbers play out. Then the third thing I wanted to touch on, and maybe you've all been kind of aware of it, is we may be moving into the world of point of care testing in Steamboat Springs. And I shouldn't say may, I think we are. To date, the FDA has mostly given emergency use authorizations to PCR tests originally, bunch of antibody tests. And they gave a first approval to an antigen test back in May. And that one was by labs by Sophia and Quidel. And at that time, their self-reported data says that their sensitivity was maybe 80-85%. Not great. Well, just last week, they updated their emergency use authorization data to claim that their sensitivity test on the antigen is up to 96-97%. That's a big jump, and it's actually comparable to PCR testing. They got quite a bit of news. There's been a second antigen test approved by emergency use authorization. This platform is already used by some clinics in our community to test for flu. They were using it, say, last winter. So it makes it easy for them if they just get the new cards and reagents to move into this world. I've canvassed some of the clinics in town, and it appears that everybody's looking into this. And I think there's a possibility that within a couple months, the various clinics, urgent care facilities all in town will have this kind of point of care testing. And I've tried to frame my use of the word rapid, because you can do a PCR test rapidly. But these point of care tests would give you an answer within minutes, 15 minutes, say. So they truly are the rapid test. Now I would qualify things a little bit by recognizing that when the FDA gave emergency use authorization, all these antibody tests, many of them turned out to be basically junk. And the couple antigen tests that have been approved have not gone through the formal FDA vetting process. But what I've seen is this new antigen test appears to be the real deal. And I know we're always talking about how we can get faster turnaround. And I accept that we are stuck at a 48-hour window on PCR tests. I don't see in the near future that locally we'll have the capacity at the hospital, or because the only ones qualified to do the PCR tests. And as we've seen nationally, we're just not getting the PCR reagents distributed. So our answer to be quicker is to probably move into this antigen world. And the costs for that, I think, will be reasonable for people. It's going to be less than $50. I don't know where exactly, but it will not be $199 or something. And that might be helpful. Even if those tests are not perfect, a positive test from an antigen test is a true positive. The issue will be, if you get a negative, do you rely on that, or do you need to do a backup PCR test? That has to do a little bit with the qualities of the antigen test. But to the question that we've been discussing for some time, can we get more rapid turnaround? Yes, if it's believed that this test is worthwhile and we have clinical entities in town that go for it, I think then we can get there. The question we'll need to decide, and Roberta and I have some ongoing conversations about this, is if it makes sense for public health to also purchase this test, which is not cheap, and have capacity in the public health realm to also be doing these tests. I think that ends my comments.
I think the antigen test question is an interesting one, because you and I talked about this the other day, Dr. Harrington, but from the public health side, if all the clinics start doing this with a quick turnaround, then our community testing that takes 2 or 3 days starts to become somewhat irrelevant and probably not of interest to people to participate in that if they can get such a quick turnaround time. So I think it's definitely a worthwhile discussion about how we move forward.
The antigen testing, so you got to have the equipment, and then you have to get the reagent and the cards. And I talked to the distributor in Colorado for this company, and I did glean that it's not a slam dunk that there's going to be a lot of this stuff available for us locally. Their company is a national company, and like we've seen before, there is some preference given to the hotspot areas, so I'll blame Texas. Some of this stuff will be going to Texas. I think that many vendors will favor pre-existing clients, and they will favor large volume purchasers. So that can play a little bit into the ability of local entities here getting it. But I believe that one clinic in town may already have a few of the reagent cards. And also it's the pathway exists and appears to be working. It's just, is it going to be at the volume that we can make use of it? I did get some cautionary notes that, yeah, as everybody starts to jump on board with this, that demand is going to crimp the supply. And so it's not a guarantee that people can get the volume that they want or when they want it. But I think this is going to become a real deal. And so I that'll be important as we get into cold and flu season, that we have this ability to do something different and better than our current test regime that's been too slow in giving results.
Boy, will this complicate your reporting issues.
Well, yes. We will. I don't foresee that we can ever divulge ourselves from having to do some local pen and paper tabulation stuff. It's just like, I mean, the state does not tell us how many tests are run. Now, they've got a data sheet we're looking at that appears to have some, maybe all of that. We still may be stuck at times, as we have been doing, getting the various clinical entities to give us their reports so we can have that too. And right now, they're all required to report their results, especially the positive results. And I would assume that would be the same with this. But as you're pointing, Commissioner Corrigan, this is, you know, it's my clinic. We have a test in the office. We have the result. It's up to us then to report those to the state or report to anybody else. The more of that we have going on, the more potential gaps there are in the data reporting.
So the positive results that are being reported by the state and being reported by us, are they exclusively the PCR test?
Yes. Now the antibody tests that are positive also get reported to them. But the data sheet that Roberta and I work with, I mean, as it gives us the different columns, I mean, confirmed means it's a confirmed PCR test. Mm-hmm. There are antigen test reports on that data sheet to date.
So they're not reporting the antigen tests results?
They have not yet. And I think that's because nobody's been doing them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, there's other tests out there. There's, you know, you've heard about the saliva test. People are doing that stuff, which by my understanding is not up to the standard of PCR testing and not up to the standard of antigen testing. Mm-hmm.
And Commissioner Corrigan, also in that data set, we have that CDERS, the electronic reporting system, they have all of the negative tests as well that were submitted. So if it comes back negative, so right now in that spreadsheet, we have over 6,000 entries. So we could use that, because if you look at the state data, they have how many tests were submitted to CDPHE and also to commercial labs. And that's where that they're getting that data. And so that would be a nice transition too, because what I found is a Route County resident could be tested on the Front Range. And, you know, it's not a local lab or facility here per se. So I don't think historically we've been capturing that data, you know, from what's going on if someone goes down to Children's Hospital and gets tested, you know, and so that would increase our denominator for that testing positivity rate.
So related to that, I think I understand correctly what you're saying, but my understanding is that the need to get that information, how many tests had been administered, was why we had staff spending so much time calling the clinics. And so do I understand that may not be necessary, which would be a huge relief if somebody doesn't have to spend time doing that, that data is actually available to us from the state?
Yeah, so if they, you know, submitted it to CDPHE, there's a lot of the larger lab, like LabCorp is on there. So, you know, that data is in there on the CDERS spreadsheets. So I haven't gone through to match, you know, what is in cedars versus what we've hand collected. I haven't gotten to that process yet, but I do think, you know, that would be a good denominator to look into and transition to potentially.
I feel that's one data area though we're going to have to personally verify.
Right.
In mm-hmm. the past, when I looked at this, it was clear that some of the labs did not have to or were not reporting their negative tests. They were just required to report their positive tests. So we will need to verify that their positivity rate data, or we'll need to verify what it is. Mm-hmm. I think CDPHE lab data is robust.
Right.
But unclear on their other sources.
But again, it would be consistent with what CDPHE is putting on their website as well. So if you go to their main data page, they have that information on CDPHE labs versus non-CDPHE labs. So then we can break that down by Route County resident.
All right, well, this has been a really interesting exposition of all of the problems of data gathering. And I mean, honestly, count me among those people that really wondered why this was so much rocket science and how could it possibly be that complicated. But I'm beginning to more fully appreciate how complicated it is with so many various data sources and getting it to all line up. So I guess my question for the commissioners and for public health, do you guys feel like you have a clearer path forward in terms of data gathering and reporting than what we had before today? Or do you need any more, does public health need any more direction from the commissioners in order to move forward?
So, I don't know how we're going to give direction. I mean, I trust, and especially if we get the epidemiologist on board and the rest, that, you know, I'm not going to second guess what they're coming up with. And so I just want to make sure that Beth said it pretty well. We want to be transparent. We want to be open and we want to be accurate. And yet somehow we have to figure out how to get all the information out there that's relevant, including, as Dr. Harrington said, those people that are here that are not residents here. And I like to see what those case counts are. And so, I live more to the day, more to the today, and not necessarily so much what, and kind of and figuring out how we're happening and going from there. So.
Okay. I mean, Doug, I totally agree with that. I mean, that's why we have these professionals working for us. And it sounds like they're giving it the proper amount of thought to come up with something that's going to work for guiding policy and informing the public. So we'll leave it to them.
So
I'd like to add a last statement to reiterate that I have full confidence and comfort with our data as we've tabulated it through recent months and the decisions we made on it. Mm-hmm. We had one person, Michelle Lewis, who did an amazing job doing exactly what we've talked about. And it has just gotten to the point here where there are multiple data sources or different test results. I mean, it's grown. It's just mm-hmm. gone beyond the ability of kind of one position to do it. And it's, I mean, I know that just drove her nuts trying to work all day and night trying to get this sorted out. So it's come time for us to have a different process. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be different in terms of we're somehow going to have different results. No, the information that we've gleaned to this date, I have comfort, was accurate and has found our decisions appropriately on it. Mm-hmm.
The interesting part in my mind is that we're having to and trying to figure this out in a reporting mechanism here locally, which then creates the issue is how do you compare your numbers, in which the Cedar sounds like a great thing. How do you compare your numbers to what Summit County's doing or what Eagle County's are doing when we're all maybe using a different recording system and putting apples and apples in the same barrel. So anyhow.
Right. And I also think as well with any information or requests when we go to the state, if our data matches state data, I think that's going to be easier for requests moving forward and decisions moving forward as well when we're reaching out to them.
All right. What else do we want to talk about while we have our public health folks with us today?
I want to just ask I'm glad we've had so much discussion about the data. I guess I'd like to talk a little more about what the data means. Dr. Harrington, I heard you say that we've been pretty steady in terms of the number of new cases we've had over a 2-week period. I guess from sort of a public health and a policy standpoint, how do we feel about that? Because it's still a fairly, I don't know if I'd use the word high, but probably higher than we would like, number of new cases each week. And I know we don't really have the capacity to do full modeling, you know, like the state does, and our numbers are probably too small to really do that well anyway. But how do we think about that? And how do we think about planning going into the future? I'm especially thinking about, schools reopening, ski season starting, people moving inside. You know, what's happening now is absolutely going to impact all those things. So I guess from either or both of you, I'd like just some insights on how we should be thinking about where we are now from a public health standpoint.
Right. Is our current prevalence of disease, as indicated by positive cases, is it low, medium, or high? Is it rising or falling? So as I said at the beginning of my comments, my estimation is that we have stayed stable. We certainly have not decreased in cases, but I also cannot say that we've increased. I've said here for a few weeks, it appears, as I look at the numbers, that we average about 7-8 cases a week, and it's kind of interesting. We've just stayed, I think, fairly stable there. Our case rate, though, per population does put us in this medium level, when you look at the Protect Our Neighbors framework and those kind of things. So that's it's an undesirable level of disease. I wish we could get to zero. I don't know if we're going to get to zero cases in any week period here or the rest of the year. We may not. Our deaths, we did have a death at the Haven. But besides that, we've not had deaths, so that's a marker of disease prevalence in a way, so that's reassuring. But since we're staying stable, what else do we need to do to get that rate down? Or do we just accept that this is an acceptable rate of disease? It probably is not an acceptable rate of disease to the extent that we say, this is where we are, we're okay with that. I don't think the sky is falling. I also want to kind of counter it by saying that. It's just, I think we should be striving for lower prevalence of disease. I've kind of been waiting. I've been hoping that we would get clear metrics in terms of case positivity rate, in terms of caseload. I mean, that Harvard Institute of Global Health, of course, has that case population average. I've been waiting for some kind of dictum from on high and say, all right, this is what our evidence says. These are the numbers that if you get above this, you've got to change. And there is some of that. The Harvard Institute of Global Health stuff talks about if you get above 10 per 100,000 on your daily average, that you need to be doing things different. Our Protect Our Neighbors has some references to that in terms of different areas. So we're not totally devoid of that, but it's not as precise as and not as consistent as I wish it would be. Mm-hmm.
And to tag on to that as well, you mentioned opening schools, and the state did come out with outbreak guidance. Just last week, they released that document. And I was on a couple conference calls this week where they were looking at, how to manage sick kids at school. And some of those algorithms and pathways are really determined on the amount of community spread. in your community and how you manage those. So, you know, a lot of our medical decision making, a lot of what we're doing to treat and test for people is really going to be a factor too of what we're seeing in our communities and how that's going to be changing. And that's why communication and getting the data out there is going to be critical, especially with back to school and also with our compounding influenza season as well.
So, Dr. Harrington, back to your first comments. I mean, it sounds to me, I would describe what you said as that this is a manageable level of disease prevalence, but it's not ideal, right? I mean, it sounds like our contact tracing is able to keep up with it. We're generally able to control outbreaks, you know, that sort of thing, but that ideally it would be lower because that would put us in a better place as we're moving into some of these higher risk situations in the fall. I guess I'm curious, based on the contact tracing and based on what you all are learning about how people are getting sick, you know, short of shutting things down, which I think unless we feel like we're moving toward the unmanageable stage is probably not desirable. What could be done, or, you know, whether not necessarily us issuing orders on things, but what do we need to be telling the community? What are the things that we could do that are less restrictive than, you know, shutting down various business sectors, but that might help to better control or lower that disease prevalence in our community before it does get to that unmanageable stage?
Yeah, and I think I've mentioned before, I've kind of seen this in two pathways. You either do better at what you're doing or you add some new tools. And do we believe that we are maximizing the effect of our current tools, whether that being mitigation plans for businesses, whether it be group gathering sizes, whether it be mask wearing, you know, going on. Is our education there so everybody's on board and understands what they need to be doing? Have we maximized that? I'm sure there's room for us to improve on that. If we felt that we've maximized that, then I do think it puts more weight on this idea of what other things should we be doing that we are not doing. Because we've gone along this way, and to some degree I've said this is a success story. I thought we would have more cases by now, and that's what some predictions at the state level were. And with our influx of people coming in here to the town during summer and our efflux, because all of us have been going to places too. And so that combination, that increased travel might have led to a significant rise in cases. And I can't say that I've seen that. Mm-hmm. So that's good news story. So in spite of some of those extra risk factors, we've kept it stable. I'm now going to be curious to see if we get out of kind of the summer tourist season, which in my mind goes on for another week or two, but then, you know, as we get into latter August, everybody's travel may be going down. Do we at some point in September start to see that reflected with lower cases? I don't know. Of course, at the same time, we've got school starting, so that will cloud that a bit.
Mm-hmm. What has been surprising to me is, you know, looking at our cases, you know, just over the past week and trying to understand our cases, you know, how many people say, oh, I didn't have symptoms, you know, the asymptomatic. And then, so that kind of gave an awareness to me. I mean, I understood that we have this, but seeing that in person now has really hit home. And then when I'm out in the community, I'm seeing people together. They've got masks on, but they're not, you know, 6 feet apart. I want to say, hey, put a llama between you or a bicycle between you. You know, just, I know you guys know each other, but please just get away. And because there is that asymptomatic spread, and I just hope that we're stressing that hopefully we're not feeling too comfortable. And we need to, you know, do the hellos from a distance. We need to be separated, really limiting your interactions if you can still. You know, we're not out of the woods, and we still need to use, as Dr. Harrington said, those tools that we have. We need to not let our guard down, and we still need to be doing those things, because that is ultimately what is going to help us. You know, the testing just gives us an idea of what's going on, but it's the tools that we use that are going to help the prevention.
And I, you know, there's a qualified success story here. Our community economy and businesses have been open, and I qualify it because many have not been open to the degree that they need to be. They're working at reduced staff and so forth. So I want to make sure I'm not saying that this has been a success in that full degree, but businesses have been open. And I mean, we see around the country now, places have had to retrench, close things down, and never got, maybe in some places, fully open. So I applaud the members of our community for the things they have been doing, because we have gotten through the summer and are getting through kind of the tail end of the tourist industry and the travel here for all the members of our county. And I think we could have been in a much worse state.
So this is a really relevant conversation, because as we consider possibly entering Protect Our Neighbors, we really don't have a good path forward to enter Protect Our Neighbors until we reduce disease prevalence. And that is a little bit frustrating, because I've had conversations with a number of people asking, well, you know, when will we be able to start opening up a little bit more? And I've been kind of holding out this hope that, well, we're working on this Protect Our Neighbors framework, and hopefully through that framework, we'll get to do some more incremental lifting of restrictions. But that's not really going to happen, is it, Commissioner Melton?
Well, you know what I hear, Dr. Harrington has said this the last 2 weeks, and we can't just hope, you know, if we can't just keep doing the same thing and hope that we're going to get a different outcome, you know? And so if our goal is to lower disease prevalence, which I think is probably always the goal, you know, we have to identify the things that need to be done differently. And honestly, we're not in an urgent, you know, red alarm, five alarm fire situation. And so now is the time to really think about what that is, because there could come a time where we have to move backwards, because there is such disease prevalence in our community. And so making sure that we're doing everything we can now before that, I think, is probably really important. And I guess I would just say what I heard Roberta say that maybe is important for us to think about, and this probably is really on Robin's end of things. You know, we've done a lot of work really normalizing and encouraging mask wearing, and I think we've been very successful as a community in that. We need to do the same thing with distancing, you know, and it's not natural. It's not normal. It's not human nature. And as Roberta said, I think probably all of us could say that we've experienced this. Oh, well, I know you, you know, we're friends or we're family or whatever. And so I'm not going to offend you by standing 6 feet away, but knowing that there's that high prevalence of asymptomatic cases, you know, what are the things we can do to help normalize that pretty socially awkward behavior, quite frankly? And these are the kinds of things public health is good at, right? Is helping to teach people new behaviors and helping people to understand new safety measures. So that's the one thing that I heard you say that maybe should be something we think about is what does that look like, and how do we help our community accept that as a sort of new normal behavior that they need to engage in?
I mean, to the credit of the state and the Protect Our Neighbor framework, they did lay down some criteria. That's great. We all know what we're talking about. It's transparent. But that criteria would give us a seemingly unclear or weak path forward currently with our current state of disease. And so, I mean, I'd like to say that we could move forward on it, but just by their criteria, we would not be able to easily do that. And maybe Roberta, you've heard something this week. You know, the state put a moratorium on variance considerations for 2 weeks, starting on July 16th. Well, here we are 2 weeks out. I didn't see anything. Have you heard anything, Roberta? Have they extended that? Are they considering variances now?
Commissioner Melton, I think you had sent an email in regards to that just this morning.
Yeah, I did. I spoke with someone at CDPHE this morning and asked that question, you know, because given our disease prevalence, my question was, do we need to consider withdrawing our variants? You know, are we really ready to go in that direction? And her indication was that they are continuing to review variance requests, but they are only considering them for folks that are in, she used the term green zone, which I sent you guys that document from it said it came from the White House. I hope it didn't actually come from the White House, but sorry to get political. But there, it sounds like maybe the state is looking at using that red, yellow, green that mm-hmm. is coming from the national level. And so she said, we're really only looking at variance requests for communities that are in that green zone, which I think was a certain number of cases per 100,000. I didn't have time to read that in depth. And that are for kind of one-off events. So like if you're in a community that's in that green zone and you want to have a hot air balloon rodeo, you know, then they're considering those types of variances at this point and nothing else. But the other thing I said in that email is that they are looking at revamping that whole thing because it's sort of a disaster, as I'm sure we all appreciate. It's been very messy. And I was asked to participate in a task force that's looking at how to do that and meeting pretty intensively over the next like 4 days. So looking, I think, at trying to do that pretty quickly.
So I would say that our current disease prevalence and its impacts are, as you said, Commissioner Corrigan, at a manageable level. We're managing hospital capacity, we're managing PPE supplies, we're managing testing, we're managing case contact tracing, we're managing the disease death and disability part. But in terms of the metrics for moving forward and opening up things, we're not managing it to that degree because I don't think we're at that point where we're easily able to move forward.
Well, the protect our neighbors, you know, I was skeptical whether we would get to that place with the disease prevalence anyhow, but I'm thinking more about it now, and I think it's a good route that we're doing, and we're spending the effort, and that we're getting the disease prevalence, you know, somewhat, stable at least, and which I believe will the protect our neighbors, the criteria and the rest, and us going through the homework and doing those things will help us in this increasing risk factor time that we're going to be moving into with the schools opening and the rest and figuring out how. So maybe we can open schools a little bit and do some education as well, and that we're not through the implementation of the protect our neighbors, we're not going to be ultimately blowing up our risk factors and the rest. So it would be my thought. So
I have a question for Dr. Harrington. Brian, thank you very much for interfacing with the school districts and having those conversations with them. Are you comfortable with the direction that the schools are taking? And do you believe that they've got good plans in place in case they start seeing increased disease prevalence? Because I think the last thing we would want to do would be, or at least I would want to do, I'm pretty uncomfortable interfering with how the schools go about taking care of their own business. But on the other hand, we need to make sure that what they are doing and planning on doing will help us stay in a good place.
I would say yes on both accounts. I don't know every facet. I've had conversations with many of the local school people through the past couple months. I'm comfortable with the direction they're going, and I believe that they've all taken deliberate, thoughtful, reasoned approaches to trying to plan this out, and they're doing the best they can. I'm actually very impressed with the amount of forethought and work they're putting into all the facets of disease mitigation and all that. It's not the elephant in the room, but the challenge is, though, that they are connected to what's going on in the communities for disease. And that is the area that I still struggle a little bit in terms of, because everybody wants to know this tripwire. You know, at what point do they move? So the schools can do all remote learning, all in-person learning, or some hybrid in between. And that also varies by age level. It could be that the high school students, if we have enough disease going on, that they don't meet in public or don't meet in person, but maybe the elementary students can. So there's these kind of these variations, and those are all supposed to be dictated by what's going on in the community. So while we, and I'm comfortable with the, you know, school districts, they're very informed, they're doing a lot of work on this. I don't feel it's exactly our position to tell them what to do or not to do. However, their success is dependent on what kind of the public health arena is doing with the disease prevalence. So we have a role in that. And then of course that feeds back. If we're concerned about our population being able to work and do all those things, all that's spending having their kids in school so that they can be able to work and not have to worry about childcare. And so to that degree, we need to help out finding ways that things can continue in our community. That will be, I think, the discussion point is kind of at what levels of disease and at how do you measure that? Do you dictate changes in practice in the schools? And then that falls into our realm in terms of what are we doing to make the environment such that the schools can be successful.
And I have been talking to some of the school nurses. They reached out from the Steamboat District. And so, you know, all of their guidance says refer to public health and what public health is doing. So I think for sure it's a huge collaboration that we're going to have good communication. Because again, of my industrial hygiene background, I was curious what type of filters they were putting in their HVAC systems and some of their cleaning and disinfection protocols. So, you know, just the preliminary conversations I have, you know, they are considering all of these things. They are looking at all of the guidance. And as with any industry, there's so much guidance coming from multiple angles. It's, you know, we need to work in partnership to distill that and make sure that the decisions that are being made, you know, are right for our community. So I do think, you know, we need to continue that partnership and those conversations moving forward to be there for them.
All right, thank you. Is there anything else that we felt was important to discuss with our public health team this morning?
Roberta, do you want to talk about vaccinations and flu vaccines?
Yes, because I always love to. Thank you. So I was able to get some information from CDPHE. I was a little bit concerned about flu vaccines for this next coming flu season. We are working on, I got a list of refrigerators to go shopping for. So essentially for our VFC contract, we need to provide the state a quote for a VFC refrigerator. And then they will add that money for the refrigerator to our contract. So then that supply would be covered. In terms of flu vaccine, I was a little bit nervous last week. You know, has anyone ordered flu vaccine? Will there be flu vaccine that we can offer through public health? It sounds like CDC has increased the supplies to our VFC program because of the emphasis of getting your influenza vaccination this season. So we would have access to that supply of flu vaccination through the state. So that was a reassuring conversation. I'm still working with them to fulfill some of that information they need for the contract. But, you know, once we also kind of determine where we will put this refrigerator, you know, it needs, the thing that's special about this refrigerator is that it does continuous temperature monitoring. That's part, if you're getting federal vaccines, you need to monitor temperatures. So, you know, on the weekend, if the power went off, someone would receive a phone call saying, hey, we've got, you know, thousands of dollars of vaccines that might spoil. You need to, you know, do something. So, so that information was reassuring, and I continue to work on that, as that is a huge priority to get solved right now.
That raises another question I had, which may be looking too far down the road, but if by some miracle we actually have a COVID-19 vaccine available late this year and or early next year, it's obvious what a global logistical challenge it will be to get that out, but taking it down to a local level, ideally, we would be vaccinating roughly 26,000 people here in Rauch County. Logistically, what would that look like for Rauch County Public Health?
Right. We would have to enlist some volunteers. Some, you know, I when I did influenza vaccinations in the healthcare setting, you know, we had what we called flu captains. And these were the people that, you know, went to conference rooms in a community setting. You could see it, you know, flu shots being offered, you know, perhaps at the grocery store or places where people convene. You know, we would certainly have to deploy a large group of nurses, and, you know, there are, you know, pharmacists can also give vaccines if they have the appropriate certifications. So we would definitely want to look at what we have in terms of resources to actually administer the vaccines. I believe as well, with a new vaccine, a lot of this is going to be having priority. You know, they're going to look at different risk levels first. Probably, you know, healthcare workers will be prioritized to that vaccine, our EMS workers, all of those kind of more high level that might have potential patient contact. I would foresee that being a tiered approach before we got down to the community level for administration. So we will definitely have to work with our hospital and medical partners to, you know, ramp up for that and availability. So,
Go ahead, doctor.
Well, there's a comment. When you think about vaccinations, you know, you have a vision of what work goes in the community or what you see happening in the community for it. So with pediatric vaccinations, we usually talk about 80-90% vaccination success rate. But the realistic model probably is influenza vaccinations. And Roberta, correct me if I'm wrong, but our national influenza vaccination success rate is usually around 45% or something. It's often less than half of the citizens get vaccinated. And that's in spite of a lot of localized efforts for it. So imagine that if we want to get 80-90% vaccination rate for COVID, both the education piece and the logistic piece, it's got to literally double what we are doing with influenza in a typical year.
Yeah, and I think part of the relevance of this conversation is that while we've been the beneficiary of CARES funding that's put us in a position to ramp up public health capacity between now and the end of the year, the likelihood is that the a big vaccination effort is going to be happening in 2021, and we don't really know what our resources are going to be available at that time.
So, you know, all the clinical entities, just like they do with flu and other things, will carry the vaccine, I'm sure, at some point. But that's a little bit of a biased population. It's those with health insurance. It's those who have the means to access healthcare. We'll have a lot of segments of our population who cannot access those venues as well. And we'll need to think about how we get to them, educate them, and have supplies for them, some of whom we may not have even the financial means to pay for vaccines.
So Dr. Harrington, when do you, what's your educated guess? We hear a lot of hopeful information on the national level about the potential success of producing a vaccine, and we're hearing potentially late this year, early next year. Is that an eventuality that you think we should be planning for right now?
Yeah, Brian Harrington thinks that he's going to get a needle in his arm sometime after Christmas. I don't expect that I'm going to get poked before Christmas. Phase three trials are going on right now are going to take a month or two. I mean, they've got to follow people off for a while to understand, the rate of infection when they have the vaccine. Once that's done, then there's this whole logistic process of making a vaccine, stocking vials, distributing syringes and vials to places. I'll be very surprised if we're seeing something before Christmas. On the other hand, psychologically, I know everybody's looking to have something before the end of the year. And so there's a lot of pressure to put that man on the moon, so to speak. And then there is, the kind of the practicality was going, boy, can we get a vaccine before we get into the depths of winter? So maybe that'll motivate stuff to get done. I just, I'm not an expert on understanding how this is going to happen, but my sense is I don't expect any of us to get poked until after Christmas.
And I agree with that.
Sorry, Roberta.
I was going to say, I agree with that. I mean, yes, it's one thing to have a vaccine in trials, but again, it's another for mass production, and it's mass production worldwide. You know, with influenza vaccines, we see seasonals where influenza season in the southern hemisphere is not the same timing as the northern hemisphere. So this is where we are distributing vaccine worldwide that has been created. So again, some of the supplies, and then also a thought, you know, looking at our resources, you know, I think what we need to start doing, if it hasn't been done already, is getting a list of medical volunteers that could potentially be able to vaccinate, because this is going to be a demand nationwide for vaccinators and people. So maybe looking at securing some of those resources earlier rather than later might be beneficial.
And this is part of our Protect Our Neighbors planning, is both a flu vaccination plan for this winter or this fall, but also planning for the eventuality of having a COVID-19 vaccine. And I think exactly what Roberta is saying, you know, identifying people and resources and what deployment of that would look like to the best of our ability. There are going to be some unknowns, obviously, but that's definitely a planning effort that we're looking at. On flu vaccines, Dr. Harrington, I've heard you refer to the fact that we might want to be encouraging folks to get them early this year. What does early mean exactly? I mean, are we looking at like in the next few weeks, in September, in October? What's kind of the, I always get mine in November, so that's why I'm asking.
Right. No, and I just, the way it works out, I often get mine maybe in September or even early October. This year, though, I'll probably be getting mine as soon as we get them in my clinic. I think some of the pharmacies in town already have some flu vaccine, and I expect that the clinics, as kind of par with previous years, that we'll see most of the clinics in town be getting their supplies by the end of August. So to that point, I would suggest that people get their flu vaccines here in September and not wait this year. Again, the rationale for that is there's always the medical rationale with influenza. Influenza kills people and in its own right needs to be dealt with. But this year, we want to reduce the amount of coughs, fevers, respiratory illnesses that we face with as we try to sort through who's got COVID and how people can stay at work and stay in school. And when we look at the capacity thing each year, you know, when we talk about tens of thousands of Americans dying, many of those people die in a hospital. And many people I know each year here, we usually have a few people hospitalized with influenza. We want to save those bed spaces for COVID patients. You know, we've had all this discussion about the capacity to take care of COVID patients. If that increases in our state and locally, we want to save as many beds as possible to deal with that. And since influenza illness and death is preventable to the degree that the vaccinations help, we want to encourage vaccinations.
All right, well, it is 11:30, and I'd like to respect everybody's time. I'm sure our public health folks have got pretty important things to attend to. So if commissioners, if you don't have any more questions or comments, I'd be happy to move on to public comment. Kendra or Deanna, whichever one of you is available. There you are, Kendra. You can go ahead and provide instructions. I see we have quite a number of attendees today on how to give public comment. I would make one comment of my own. We've received during the meeting today several emails that say that that they're meant for public comment. My judgment of those emails is that they were really more questions than they were public comment. So I'm not going to read those questions that came via email into public comment, but I would invite any of the individuals that have been sending those emails to take advantage of this opportunity to make public comment. So Kendra, why don't you go ahead and provide the instructions?
Yeah, so the way public comment works is you will raise your hand and then we'll call on you in turn in order of the hands raised. If you're on the phone, you would need to press *9. And if you're on the computer, you would just use the raise your hand function down at the bottom of the screen. And then just remember when you're called on, if you're on the phone, you need to unmute yourself on the phone, but then also press *6 to unmute yourself through the Zoom program. And if you're on the computer, once you're called on, you'll also need to unmute yourself.
Okay. So I did see one hand raised and it went down and now it's back up. So I will call upon Dave to go ahead and provide public comment. And Dave, for the record, if you would please identify your full name.
Hello, can you hear me?
I can. Go ahead, Dave.
My name is Dave Corey, Steamboat Springs. I live in your district, Tim, and I have been for the last month auditing all the data that's been released to the public from the county. And been doing our own data analysis on it and been reporting discrepancies, including to you. And I wanted to compliment you on hoping that our data is accurate rather than put out in haste. And in the emails that I did send to you just now during the meeting, I'm bringing some data discrepancies to the attention. And some very simple transparency is all that I'm asking for here. And that's that a daily count.
Dave, I think we lost you. I think you muted yourself. There you go.
Excuse me.
We can hear you now, Dave.
Anyway, I'm trying to do data analysis, quality assurance for the information that's been reported by the county. We've been auditing every press release since the beginning of COVID that we could obtain. And recently we've hit some brick walls with how do we find press releases? How do we find press releases that were from March and from May? On the website, they were difficult to find. And we did some forensics and dug around and got the news we could. They've all been tabulated. And we're looking at about 10 cases that have been missing since April in our count. And I don't know what data set that you use to make decisions, but I'd like to know. And so if there's any way that we could publicly make the information available of what our count is and on what days they were counted so that they could be compared by the public, that'd be very appreciated. It's very frustrating to look at the data now and not have faith in it. If you look at the dashboard, within the last 12 hours, we went from an update last night where one of the metrics hit critical. And now today, it's not hitting critical. And so whatever updates were made in the data from last night and this morning, we'd like to see what they are. Right? We'd like to audit that. And so I would ask that any spreadsheets that the doctor is referring to and the math and the numbers that we're referring to make these public decisions regarding our health are made public in the essence of transparency. While we're auditing things and we hear about these delays for months, it doesn't bring any confidence to the public. If we can't believe the data coming from the county, then we have to look to the non-rumor data, which is Colorado Department of Public Health. We look at Johns Hopkins University. We look at anywhere we can. And those cases are counting at 108 and 110 right now. And we're also being told that those are delayed 24 or 48 hours over what our public health has information to. So that means that number should always be lower than what the county is reporting to us. And at one point there was good county reporting through the newspaper. The pilot was actually ahead of our count in comparison for quite a while. Right now it's about on the level playing field, but the delay isn't there anymore. And so when I read the news release yesterday, it looks like the county is giving up on using their own data to make decisions. And instead, they're relying on CDPHE. But when you go to the dashboard, that's not CDPHE data in there. And that data hasn't been given to the public. And so I would ask that the spreadsheets that are used for our dashboard and the raw numbers that you're using to do math that you're discussing in these meetings is presented to the public. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. Is there anybody else that would care to make public comment today? I am not seeing any raised hands, so I am going to go ahead and close public comment and move on to the rest of our agenda today. Thank you, Dr. Harrington and Roberta. Appreciate the update very much. All right. Next item on the agenda is a purchasing item for some overlay. Julie, are you on the line, or who's presenting this to us today?
Hi.
I'm here. Hi, Julie.
Hi.
Go ahead, Julie.
So, would you like to start with the overlay 688 IFB?
I'd like to start with whatever you want to start with, Julie.
Okay, thank you. All right, so I'm here to request the Board of County Commissioners approve the purchase for overlay 2020, the BCC chair to sign the notice of award, and authorize the county manager to electronically sign the purchase order to Old Castle Southwest Group, Inc., DBA United Companies, in the amount of $900,098,890. So, as you know, we went out for bid prior to looking at our 2020 budget for road repairs in May. And the original budget of $1,683,760, that was to do County Road 18 and several alternate roads. But due to the impact of COVID-19 and the extensive budget review, that was reduced and recently has been reallocated to the amount we are awarding of $998,890. Old Castle has held their bid price even with the reduction. They understand our situation. And we had sent this out to our two known vendors for this project, and the price per ton by Old Castle was about $5 per ton less. So that's how they were selected.
Questions for Road and Bridge, or for Julie, commissioners? I just have one question, Julie and Gio. How does this cost per ton compare to last year or past years?
Oh, I think I can check last year, but we're pretty on point with the cost. Let me go back to last year real quick and look. 2019, we paid.
I'm looking forward to.
Yeah, so we paid 87. Actually, we pay 82 and 85. Because it also depends on the location, Tim, on the hauling. So, for example, on County Road 14, we paid $82 per ton last year. Then County Road 62 up in Clark, because of the long hauling, we paid $91 per ton, 80 on 179. So the closer they get to their pit, or actually coming from Craig in this case, because it was Elam Construction last year. So obviously the cost is going to be less the closer to them. This year, however, United, which is in Hayden, $85 and $80 per ton. So we're like basically low, pretty low actually.
A bit, pretty comparable. No big change year over year. Okay.
No.
That's all I'm saying.
Well, you know, as you recall, in May we really thought that we'd see some reduction due to the price of oil and all, and nothing really changed that dramatically.
Yes, they're pretty consistent.
Okay. Any other questions, commissioners?
Yeah. So this will require a supplemental budget because we wiped it out during our COVID adjustments and the rest, and we'll have to have a supplemental budget to put it back in. Is that correct?
That is correct.
All right. I think we're ready for a motion here.
So, Mr. Chairman, I would move that the board of county, the move that we approve the purchase for overlay for the 2020. Authorize the chair to sign the notice of award and authorize the county manager to electronically sign the purchase order to Old Castle Southwest Group Incorporated, doing business as United Companies, in the amount of $998,890, noting that that will require a supplemental budget later time. Your end.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any more discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Next, Julie.
All right. We are here to request the Board of County Commissioners approve the purchase for Chip Seal 2020. And the BCC chairs signed the notice of award and authorize the county manager to electronically sign the purchase order to GMCO Limited Liability Company of Colorado in the amount of $98,585. We did go out for bid this spring, and again—
Hey, Julie, let me interrupt. I'm not seeing this attached to our agenda.
I think that might have been missed. It was sent to Deanna. I do have the original one. Can I email it to you right now?
Yep, that'd be good. If it's not attached, please do so.
Hold on one moment.
Beth, do you have it? Doug, do you have it?
Looks like Ray just emailed it to the BCC.
I see it.
But it's not on the agenda. Can we actually approve it if it's not on the agenda?
It was on the agenda. Well, I have the invite for the agenda item, and it was submitted on July 29th with the overlay.
Yeah, I understand all that, but it's not on the posted agenda.
Oh, I see.
I think it got missed, maybe.
Should we table this and maybe reschedule it for tomorrow or the next available?
No, we can put it on tomorrow. It'd be fine.
Yeah, it just has to be posted 24 hours. Otherwise, we're kind of out of line with our...
With your policy.
Yeah.
Requirements.
So if that doesn't hold you up too much, we probably should do that.
I don't even think we necessarily need to table it. It's just a non-issue until it shows up on the agenda.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll resend everything to Deanna and get a time for tomorrow or Friday.
Sorry about that, Julie.
Not a problem at all.
All right. Is that all you had for us today for purchasing?
Yes.
That's the right answer. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Thank you guys very much. See you tomorrow.
Okay.
Oop, I hear a voice in the background. Who is that? Okay. Let's go ahead and move on to the balance of our COVID-19 work session. I have one update. I spoke to the individual that I was talking about with available public health space and let him know that I had given him some bad information about the potential use of some of the lease space. And the, of course, it's good news, bad news. The good news is that he would be more open to allowing public health to utilize the that downstairs space that was identified as having a clinical capability, especially for vaccinations. The bad news was is that he's already leased the upstairs space, so it's no longer available. And he still was not comfortable with any kind of COVID testing, even outside on a drive-through basis. So I let him know that we would keep that information available for future consideration as we continue to look at other options for public health space.
I have a question about the public health space, and thank you for continuing to work on this. I think you know I have no interest in working on this, and so I appreciate somebody else doing it. I was just thinking about this yesterday. I guess you guys keep talking about how we need all these office spaces. Aren't we trying to encourage people to work from home? I mean, in what's the reality of how many office spaces we actually are looking at trying to secure? And I guess, is there a problem with the contact tracers continuing to work from home? Is there a problem with the epidemiologists working from home? I mean, I wouldn't say it should be just because we don't want to rent more office space, but I guess, how are you guys thinking about what's actually needed on from that end?
Who's you guys?
Whoever's working on this. I don't even, I know you're working on it, Tim. I'm just, whoever's going to end up taking this across the finish line eventually, hopefully sooner than later.
And I know Mark wants to weigh in on this. I think one of the problems that we've had is that we may not, I mean, we've been kind of letting our decisions be driven by what's available, rather than really carefully identifying the exact need. And remember, in fairness, we've been going through this transition with leadership and public health, and I'm not sure that Roberta's really even had the opportunity to come forward and say, this is exactly what I need. I need 7 offices, I need 2 clinical spaces, I need such and such a parking lot. It's kind of been, well, there's only several places even, you know, possibly available that would work, and how would we make those spaces work? But I would defer to Mark carry that forward.
Commissioners, Beth, you're heading down a path that we are exploring right now. In fact, we have a meeting today at 3:30 with some of the principals that are continuing these very important conversations. And one of the things that we now want to do is examine very, very specifically existing space that we've got within the county confines. Are we in a position where we could identify spaces together that will work for the needs of public health? And it may necessitate some move, some adjustments, some modifications to existing offices and the way we use office space with both within the historic courthouse and also the annex and also the human services building. So that's one of our focuses this afternoon, is to sit down, lay that all out and say, is there a way that we can do that within what we've got available to us right now on the campus. So, you know, and I think I mentioned this before, and I'll reiterate, everything's on the table right now. So I'm very pleased that Tim has had the ongoing conversation with the owner of the medical office building. We've not in any way, shape, or form ended our conversations with the folks that have the Hilltop property. We still are in close contact with our commercial realtor, beating the streets and kicking tires out there. So, but I think we may have a new pathway that we want to discuss this afternoon and see if there's a way that we can configure something here on the campus itself, which might be more ideal than all the other scenarios we've talked about. And I think a big part of that is because, and Tim hits the nail right on the head, we don't really exactly know how many people we're talking about that we have to accommodate both now and into the near future. So this is still being determined by Roberta, still being by determined by the pandemic crisis as we know it. So if we stay on campus, we have a little more flexibility along those lines.
If you can find enough space.
If we can
find otherwise, enough you space. Have no flexibility.
Right. And then how's the mobile testing unit fit into this conversation?
It is an ongoing, in fact, we mentioned this briefly in the recovery call this morning, Tim. We, as you may know, because, you know, you can see it out in the parking lot, we have the one existing van that we want to see if there's still any possibility of any conversion. And we're also using Moffitt County as a little bit of an example, canary in the mine shaft, in terms of what they've done in terms of trying to configure a mobile testing van. It's my understanding that what they did, they had to go and get a platform and get a chassis identified, and then they've got to do all the modifications to that. Unknown two things, how much that costs, and B, how long delivery time is to do something like that. We've been in touch with Roberta, and Roberta's been very clear that if we decide to go down that line, there are certain things that need to be in that van. In other words, it's got to have wash stations, it's got to have sanitary facilities. So I think we can all understand that it would be something that highly technical the way it's put together, and B, probably a little more expensive because it's got all those additional components that we have to have. So, but we're continuing that examination as well. And again, Moffitt County seems to be a good forerunner in terms of where the cost and where the delivery schedule might be for something along those lines.
We do have until, October, which isn't all that far away, before we lose the ability to use the rodeo grounds. Is that correct?
That is correct. In Mo's latest conversations, October was the identified date, Tim.
October 1 or October 30?
I'm not sure. I think it's October 30th, but I'll have to confirm that.
Yeah, because I can well imagine that the outfitting of a van is easily a 90-day process.
We'll get it just in time that we have to shut down, or the emergency's over on 12/31, you know. So.
12/30, Doug.
12/30. Okay, I'm sorry, I forgot that.
Before the end of the year.
Yeah.
You know what, Doug? I would say that's a win.
Well, and again, I guess
if you know, this emergency is over 12/30, then that would be a win.
No, I agree with that too. That would be a win. But yeah, I guess the other thing is, you know, short of the long range buying and building a van, I guess I need to hear from Roberta that that has a long range purpose too. So,
well, it certainly speaks to the problems associated with a multi-year lease that we're going to look pretty silly if we've got an empty facility that we're paying rent on for 2 years or something like that.
I do think, I mean, just doing the Google search, and I sent you guys the link to at least the company that Moffitt County used to outfit, you can kind of design this however you want from what I could tell. I mean, again, who knows about the delivery schedule, but I would hope Roberta would think about I know she will, all the public health uses into the future, which I imagine would include vaccinations, but also, you know, education kinds of events and the types of things that public health might do on an ongoing basis. And it may allow us to do a better job of reaching the whole county in those long-term efforts. So I think there could be a lot of positives. And again, I'm not like so excited about it that I would ignore whatever Roberta's thought on that is, but those are just, it just seems like there could be some benefits to going that direction. And it might enable us to use the county campus for office space, as Mark said.
And it's a piece of infrastructure that would easily qualify for that 150 match on the infrastructure grant.
I would think so. And we had looked, just as a side note, we had looked at some other funding options for something like this a while ago. We weren't talking about it for testing. We were talking about it for the medical surge situation. And Mo engaged in some conversations with some other funding partners at that time.
You know, all this talk about vaccines, I'm sure that the refrigerator that Roberta is going to go ahead and purchase is probably designed to accommodate our current level of vaccinations. I wonder how that would fit in with a COVID-19 vaccine, if we would just buy some more refrigerators.
They probably have a shelf life too, Tim, and there's only so many arms you can stick in a week, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, I don't know.
That's a question for Roberta.
Medical professional.
Yeah. Well, that sounds good, Mark. I mean, I think at one time we just assumed that we just didn't have the space available here. And then things changed a little bit. And it seems to be a moving target about how much space we need. And I will reiterate the public health is welcome to have my office. I mean, perfectly nice little office up here. If they need a place, especially what we're talking about here, there's a lot of this need, hopefully is just for the balance of 2020. And if you told me couldn't use my office for the next 4 or 5 months, that's fine. I can find another place to camp out. I'm working at home mostly anyway. So I know that Ray was resistant to utilizing these temporary spots in a pinch. If someone needs a home, this space is available as far as I'm concerned.
Tim, we appreciate that, and also the offer I know that's been forthcoming from the other commissioners. One thing that we want to examine today is, you know, knowing that sometimes when we announce that it's public health during a COVID crisis, it gives people pause and concerns within the community. But if we were to move another department or another unit of county government that may be a little more, I'll call it docile, maybe that's not going to cause the same ripple effect and the same issues. So we're, again, everything on the table, but we're seeing exactly how we can redeploy accordingly. So along those lines, Tim, maybe somebody from another department is going to be in your office, and then that means that office that they vacate becomes available in more of a good configuration for public health. I will also add this, commissioners. One of the things that we've noticed right off the bat with Roberta is Roberta likes coming in and likes to have a presence here on the campus. And I think what she also likes to do is make sure she gets a chance to interface with everybody, and obviously doing it also remotely. But I think the fact that we can have them in an area where they may be able to have those team meetings and discussions and share resources, I think that that's going to be something that Roberta is going to mention as a very important factor for them as we look at space.
And I think, Mark, as you're thinking about utilization of the campus space, I mean, I'm sure we don't want to kick people out, but we should remember that it's still the guidance, both from the state level and others, that people work from home if they're able to, you know, in order to minimize interactions. And so to the extent that we think that's going to be a longer term thing for some people, we may have more flexibility with our office space. And like Tim said, is it for the balance of 2020 and maybe into 2021 somewhat? It's not forever, and we know that we have a big capital project on the horizon to deal with this, but in the shorter term, can we leverage that work from home to in ways that maybe we never would have considered before this pandemic, right? But I think there could be some possibilities there too.
Yep.
Well, we'll wait till you have your conversation this afternoon at 3:30. I'm interested to hear the outcome, and again, so long range, short range, immediate range.
That's in COVID time, Doug? Is that COVID?
We've been having so much fun since March. It's hard to believe that we're into August now. It really is that right, into August now.
Yeah, I remember that day very well. I believe it was Friday the 13th, March 13th, when we issued our original emergency declaration. And I think it was that day that we had our first reported case, or right within a day or two of that date. So, yeah, it's, on the one hand, it seems like we've been doing this forever. On the other hand, it seems like we just got started on it. So who knows? Mark, do you have anything else for us that we need to consider today?
No, I don't, Tim. But I mentioned on the recovery call today that I had a chance to go out to Yampa Valley Regional Airport yesterday and do a very detailed, a very comprehensive field tour with Kevin Booth. And I just want to report to you that it's very, very impressive the way they're conducting their operations and their business in the current environment. And they're all being absolutely 100% compliant with everything we know as far as our public health orders and also our PPE requirements. So it's really impressive to see, especially when you interface with the folks with FCI and all those subcontractors. They are following everything to a T, and it's very gratifying to see that. The other thing that I want to mention related to that is that we are seeing really good progress on that Southwest Airport terminal expansion. The concrete has been poured. It was very specialized in the way that Southwest likes to see things done. Steel has arrived on site, and very confident that they're going to be able to meet the October deadline in terms of having that particular terminal expansion put together. But it's impressive to see the work going on, and everybody very dedicated to the effort at hand.
Yeah, knowing Kevin, I imagine it would be pretty risky not to do things the correct way on his at his airport.
Very true.
Mark, I haven't heard anything else about the epidemiologist interviews, except that I heard Roberta saying that she's doing just some one-on-one phone calls with those folks, but just wanted to make sure that I whatever you guys are doing is fine. I just want to make sure I get it on my calendar if we're going to schedule a time.
Mark, Beth, it sounds like what Roberta's been doing is doing some one-on-one interviews with what she considers to be those groups of finalists to try and identify then the individual that or individuals that she'd like to see the team interview. That may configure to either Friday or Monday. That's in the latest notes and emails that I've seen from Roberta's office. I can tell you also that another consideration is, and kudos to Roberta, she's also asking the question, hey, if this was offered, would you take it? And would you be available to come on board? And that's a very important conversation to have. So it's just simply not to waste anybody's time if they say, well, you know, I pitched a couple weeks ago, but I really don't think right now I can accept the position. So she's trying to narrow that down and make sure that the people that you interview are going to, in fact, be available and interested in the position. If it does, I've reminded Roberta, if it does fall on Friday, knowing your absence Beth, that we would use probably Tim as a backup. But I'm going to guess maybe it may fall more to Mondays as the way things are looking.
Yeah, either way is fine. Just want to make sure. And then remind everyone that I'm gone tomorrow and Friday. I'll be back Monday.
Doug and I will run the ship right into the rocks.
I can bet on that.
All right. Doug, you got anything?
Now we don't even have anything on tomorrow's agenda right now, so I didn't see anything. And then
just a work session, a COVID-19 work session, right?
COVID work session, yeah. And then on Friday, we will now have the GMCO,
Gypsy.
Yeah.
And an update from Mo, right?
Yep.
Robin, you have that look about you.
I just wanted to let you know of the question that we got on public comment. We had a little issue on our website platform. So now every press release back to the first press releases are all available on our website. I had a fun night last night. I had to recode them all so that we could display more than 20 at a time. So that's been resolved as of this morning.
Technology, ain't it great? Okay.
I had a comment, you know, and especially with Dr. Harrington and Roberta were talking about the contact tracers. And I don't know, Beth, you have a good conversation with Lisa, but Slickman, but I think, you know, that would create a great human interest article about what they do and the purpose. And it might be an advocate type of article, you know, that, you know, we're still having the concerns about people not communicating with the contact tracers and how that might, you know, I think right now, and not knowing in the past or knowing more now what an invaluable purpose they're serving in trying to get us past here, this COVID thing. So I don't know.
Sounds like something that Robin would maybe pitch to the media if she is interested, if she thinks it's, but I agree with you. I think it'd be great to highlight them. Although I will point out that Dr. Harrington said we're actually having pretty good
compliance
locally. But, you know, it would be great to kind of keep that up. And I think a human face to those folks and the work they do would certainly have some value.
Yeah, happy to do it to all the media. So, Steamboat about Radio, Mountain TV,
Pilot.
Everybody. So the contact tracing story is an interesting story, and we are really lucky of who we have, our head contact tracer with all that CDC experience. So that I'll do some pitching on that.
Thank you. I think it'd be valuable to the community.
I agree with you, Doug.
I saw locally, since we're still on COVID a little bit, last night watching the Denver news, and, you know, so I, you know, the hospitalizations and contact across the state are going down. So, you know, that's all positive for us too. So, I mean, for everybody. And again, as I said during our earlier meeting, that as we're heading into trying to opening the schools, it's a good thing. I guess it's allowing us to maybe talk about opening schools and things. So, but anyhow, the hospitalizations were, the rate was going down quite a bit.
Yeah, it seemed like the state really took an approach of, you know, looking at those hot spots and focusing on that rather than trying to take a statewide approach, in addition to a couple of statewide measures, the closing of bars and the mask rule. But it does seem like it's working so far on a statewide basis. So that is good news.
Yeah, I know it was must've been Friday where there was some talk coming out of CDPHE that the R naught value was getting down towards one or was at one.
I think it was at one. And then Dr. Herlihy, who's the state epidemiologist, she said, we still need to get it below one because that's how we actually reduce the number of cases. But having it at one is better than having it edging up toward two, because I think it was at like 1.7 when they decided they really needed to take drastic actions.
Yeah, that was a question I meant to ask public health earlier. is there any way to calculate the R naught value locally? And does it even have any real meaning locally?
So I have sort of an answer because I asked Dr. Harrington this question a few weeks ago. I said, is there any way to calculate our R naught? I actually asked exactly the same question you did. One, can we do it? And two, is it valid? Because we have such small N, you know, compared to the statewide basis. He didn't fully answer the question. He basically just said, well, I can't do it. So he said he just doesn't have the technical expertise to do it. So I don't, that it seems like that would be a question for once we have our epidemiologist on board of, can we calculate it locally? And is it a valid number once we do? I know one of the things, I don't know if this is true with the R naught, but the state uses a lot of, they use hospitalization data for a lot of their models because that's the only really like concrete number, because we know there are positive cases that we're not getting, right? That we're not catching through testing. And so they base a lot of their modeling off hospitalization data, and on a local basis, that number is so low that I would guess we couldn't do a lot of the same modeling that the state does, but I don't know if that applies to the R naught or just some of the other modeling.
Yeah. You're right, Doug, though that's encouraging, and you kind of wonder, we know, at least anecdotally, that this big influx of visitors that we had to Route County and Steamboat over the last, well, since July 4th, basically, is while we've had some out-of-state visitation, my takeaway is that we've had a lot of visitation from the Front Range of people coming up here. And if those bigger numbers are beginning to diminish on the Front Range, maybe we might be a little bit of a lagging indicator up here, and maybe that bodes well for us as well. Hopefully that's the case.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else before we adjourn? Oh, and Beth, you, are you going to be attending that 2:30 CCAT session?
Yeah, I'm going today. Actually, that reminds me. I don't know if you guys saw in the CCI. I did see, Tim, that you can't make it, and I will be there today. And CCI included in their email a little bit ago that the governor is doing these weekly, I don't know, regional COVID-19 response meeting something. And I had it on my calendar, but it's tomorrow. So I'll forward it to you guys what I saw. I don't know what the value is exactly, or if we'll find any value, or if it'll end up being kind of like those DOLA calls that weren't particularly useful. But it looked like it might have been at least partially in response to the accusation that the governor's office wasn't coordinating well enough with local governments, because it came out shortly after that. So I'll just forward it to you guys. And if one of you is available to listen in on that, it might be helpful. I think it's tomorrow.
Yeah, it's nothing. I mean, I don't enjoy anything any more than going to a dog and pony show. So
right. And you can always leave if it's not useful, or don't go next time or whatever, but it seems worth just checking in and listening.
Sounds good to me.
CCI has been pretty good about sending out the link at a later time, so you can watch it when you have time too. So
yeah, this was a DOLA and governor meeting, but it just came from CCI, the information. So anyway, I'll forward it and you guys can take a look. And if neither of you wants to or is available, that's obviously fine too.
Okie doke. Anything else before we adjourn? Nope. All right. Beth, you have a great weekend up in the mountains.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
And then we will see you on Monday. Doug, and Mark, and everybody, see you tomorrow.
That sounds good. Thank you.